Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Audible is the home of storytelling, from audiobooks across every genre to all your favorite podcasts and exclusive Audible originals. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Audible is the destination for thrilling audiobooks with highly anticipated new releases and next listen recommendations to pique your curiosity and sense of mystery. Best-selling titles like First Lie Wins, or the upcoming Stephen King novel, You Like It Darker. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. That's audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. So we've talked a lot on How I Built This about AI, and today AI is no longer a plaything. It's a business imperative. Your team spends half their time writing, and one confusing email can turn into 12 confused replies and a meeting to get back on the same page. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all the wasted time and money that goes with it. I have really found Grammarly to be super helpful to save time with generative AI prompts. It's also super easy to stay organized because Grammarly works great with other programs that I already use. Grammarly works everywhere you work and integrates seamlessly across 500,000 apps and websites. No cutting, no pasting, no context switching. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Learn more at Grammarly.com. You only get one chance to go public, and the stakes are high. Deloitte's free IPO readiness tool will help you grade your current state of readiness. Less than 10% of companies using Deloitte's free tool discover they're ready for an IPO. While the IPO market can be unpredictable, your company's readiness plan doesn't have to be. Don't miss your IPO window. Being ready starts with getting ready. With Deloitte's free and easy-to-use IPO self-assess tool, you can gauge your IPO readiness and receive tailored insights on 9 areas of focus in less than 30 minutes. Visit Deloitte.com/US/HIBT and launch your IPO journey today. Hello, everyone, and welcome to How I Built This Resilience Edition from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Each week on Thursdays, we invite entrepreneurs and other business leaders to come onto the show live to talk about how they've been building resilience into their businesses this year. And you can join us every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 Eastern, on the How I Built This Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn pages, or on NPR's YouTube page to hear the live conversation and maybe even ask a question. And today, my conversation with Ethan Diamond, the CEO and co-founder of Bandcamp. Bandcamp describes itself as an online record store and music community. Any band or musician can post their music on the site, sell it, and also offer merchandise and tickets for live performances. And the artists keep more than 80% of the profit. Bandcamp had been steadily growing since its launch in 2007, but last year was its biggest yet. Traffic to the site surged as concerts and festivals mostly shut down.
You know, as you said, we're essentially an online record store and music community where fans connect with artists and directly support them. And about half the business is physical records, so vinyl, cassettes, CDs, a lot of t-shirts as well. And then half the business is digital music, so people buying digital albums and digital tracks directly from the artist. And we also recently launched live streaming, so now tickets are part of it as well. But, you know, I would say that the thing that that really sets us apart is that we just built the whole company around the welfare of the artist. So we don't sell advertising. We don't really focus on subscriptions. We just help artists sell their music. And then we take a small revenue share on every sale. So what I like to say is that we only make money if artists make a lot more money. And, you know, that sort of alignment of interest that we have built into our business model is really just everything that we're about. I would, you know, we're I would say, an artist-first music company.
And something like 85% on average of the revenue goes directly to the artist, right?
Yeah, it ends up being there's payment processing fees and then there's Bandcamp's fee. So on average, and it varies by transaction size, but on average, it comes out to about 82% that goes directly to the artist. And then we pay that out it usually takes about 24 to 48 hours.
Wow. I've heard it described a little bit like Etsy for independent music. Is that a fair comparison?
Totally. Yeah. Which I take as a compliment, right? I think I think it's a really good comparison. Etsy and Bandcamp are both really large marketplaces that I think really focus on supporting the creators.
Yeah. I buy a lot of stuff off Etsy actually this past year. All right. So in the late 90s, one of my favorite books, which is when I reread it now, rethink about it now, it's a little bit dated just because of the content. But it was at the time, I was a younger man, it was High Fidelity. I love that book by Nick Hornby. I even liked the movie, even though it took place in Chicago, not in the UK. And so was that you? Like, you launched this in 2007. Were you that guy? Were you like, I'm going to launch an independent record store online? And how did you come up with the idea?
Yeah, I don't know if it wasn't quite – the thought initially wasn't really a record store. It evolved into that. So I'll take you through it. So basically what happened is about 13 years ago, there was a band that I loved, and they decided that they were going to sell their new record directly to their fans on their own website. And on the day that that record came out, I went to their site, and the site just didn't load at all. Huh. And I thought, oh, they must be slammed. I'll come back the next time. And the site loaded on that day, but it loaded very, very slowly. This was also in the days of Flash. Everything was Flash.
Yeah.
So, it took a while to figure out exactly what was going on the site. But eventually I bought the album, but then I didn't actually get anything. The transaction went through, but no music.
It was never sent to you, or was like a digital? It was going to be a digital download?
Yeah, this was a digital album.
What was the band, by the way?
I don't want to call them out because the point is that this was a lot of bands at this point. I wrote to, there was an email address on the site, and I wrote to the address, and I think it was the lead singer who wrote me back, and he just sent me a link to a zip file, a totally open zip file that, anybody could then share. And then I opened that up, and there were all of these files with names like Master 3 Final.
Yes. Yes.
Super low quality, no liner notes, nothing. And, I just basically in this process ran into like every technical problem that you could imagine.
Yeah.
And it killed me for two reasons. One, the music was amazing. And I thought they deserved all the success in the world. And, when you love artists, right, you want everybody else to hear them, right? So but I knew, as a result of all these problems, very few other people would. But, the other thing that killed me about it was that I thought that what they were doing, it made perfect sense. Of course, an artist should be able to go directly to their fans for support. The internet makes that super easy. This is the promise of it, I think. And I also think it just creates this mutual, that direct connection creates this mutually beneficial relationship, because not only does the artist get to make more music when I pay them, but also I get to feel like I'm participating in the creation of more of the art that I love. So I'm more directly connected to that music. But, this was 2007 and there were just no mechanisms like this for musicians. There was MySpace. They didn't have a way through MySpace to sell directly to fans.
Right.
And it wasn't really your site. It was, their logo, a bunch of their advertising. It was their traffic, their whole identity, right? And then so you had all of these forward-thinking bands, in my opinion, who were spending a lot of time, a lot of money building out custom sites and then ending up with something that, didn't really work. And I found that particularly crazy because, in 2007, if you were a writer, you had Blogger, Typepad, Movable, all these things that let you set up your own site very, very quickly and easily. And then it would say powered by Movable Type in the bottom.
Yeah, right.
But it was yours, right?
Yeah.
And it just seems so weird that if your artistic output was words, you had all those options. If your artistic output was music, you're out of luck. So, I wanted to solve that problem, not just for, this one artist that I ran into, but for every artist.
One of the crazy things about your business is that It's actually been profitable, I think, since 2012. And it's actually quite amazing because if you think about, and we'll talk about Spotify in a moment, but if you think about Spotify, Spotify is valued at, I don't know, like $50 billion or something like that. And they have never been profitable, right? It's never, they've never turned a profit. And it's a company that is growing and focuses on growth and has a growth strategy. What do you guys, is that part of your strategy, is growth and scale and, you know, all these terms that you, I mean, you're in San Francisco, you know these terms. Do all those terms matter to you, to your vision for Bandcamp?
No, they don't. No, I mean, we're really just focused on our mission of serving artists. That's what inspires me. That's what I get excited about doing. And I would say the company has grown and succeeded more as a side effect of focusing on that mission that we really have. And that to me is just, you know, that's a lot more satisfying than if we, I think, took the approach of, yeah, we were focused on what our mission here is, actually grow the company, get it to this size, go public, sell it, whatever it is. That just hasn't really been the focus ever.
Yeah. And I mean, basically, from the perspective of an artist, right, you put your music up on Bandcamp. And these are artists who don't generally want to work with a label, presumably. These are artists who want to retain all the rights, all the master recordings. They want to control their careers. Those are the people who put their music up on Bandcamp?
It's actually both artists who are completely independent and artists who are on labels. So we're at this point, we have almost 10,000 independent labels on the site. So Sub Pop, Merge, ATO, Ninja Tune, Relapse, just loads and loads of independent labels. In fact, I did not even know that there were so many, you know, independent labels in the world until I started working on Bandcamp. I've been blown away by that. And, you know, when a lot of people hear the word label, they think of, you know, Sony, Warner, right. Universal, right? The major labels. But there's a huge, huge number of these independent labels out there that, and some of them are really quite large, like Beggars Group. And, but you know, a lot of them are just, you know, mom and pop kinds of small businesses and yeah, they and their artists are a big, big part of Bandcamp.
So I know that like Bjork, her catalog is on Bandcamp, and Peter Gabriel, some of his work is on Bandcamp. And it may be difficult for you to answer this question. You may not know, but given the Etsy comparison, is it on average, I mean, do artists make a living off of their work on Bandcamp, or is it sort of part of a bigger ecosystem of the things they do?
I would say that any artist should be doing a lot of things, you know, right. They should be on Bandcamp and they should be in a lot of other places as well. And I think that's the approach that almost all of them take. But yeah, I mean, a lot of artists that are on Bandcamp are making significant amount of money. We hear all the time, mostly through Twitter, that, you know, the money that artists make through Bandcamp is orders of magnitude bigger than what they're making from streaming services, that it's how they're, you know, paying rent and getting equipment and buying groceries and all of that. So it's clear that we're, to me, a part of how a ton of artists are sustaining themselves. And that is great. I love hearing that. But, you know, the focus for us has never been on like measuring how many people are making over this amount, how many right. people are making over this amount, because part of what makes Bandcamp is that, you know, anybody can sign up for it. You can sign up for it tomorrow and start five different bands. And, you know, thinking about what that would mean for like the average that each artist makes, it just starts to not make any sense that we would measure it that way. Instead, what we really are measuring is like the total amount that fans are paying artists through the site, is that going up? And yeah, that's generally been the focus.
You know, Ethan, it's so interesting because when you guys came up with this concept in 2007, the conventional wisdom was that no one is going to pay for music in the future. This was just like in the sort of post-Napster era, and it was sort of pre-Spotify. But the idea was that no one was going to pay for music in the future, that it was going to be something that you just got. And to some extent, that is true, right? I mean, the sort of the major label artists make most of their money off live touring, and they're, you know, very few of them are making a lot of money off Spotify. Obviously, the biggest ones are. How did you know that people would be willing to pay for this music? Or did you know? I mean, were you at any point worried that people just wouldn't pay for it?
Yeah, I know that was definitely the hunch at the beginning, because that's what I wanted personally. You know, I wanted to have that direct relationship with an artist and directly support them. And I figured there's got to be other people out there who want to do it this way and who want to directly support artists, but there's no way to do it. It's not easy to do. And there was a moment early on that I think where everything clicked. And that was when we were looking at the search terms that people were using to get to Bandcamp that ultimately ended in a sale. And we found, again, 2008, 2009. So what we were competing with, right, as you said, was like LimeWire, right, Hookshare, stuff like that. So we looked at those search terms, and it was the name of an album plus the word torrent, or the name of an artist plus, you know, free MP3, or you know, something like that. And so, you know, I don't know that the people who were using those search terms were necessarily thinking to themselves, I want to get this music for free, or, you know, steal this music. But when they got to a place, Bandcamp, where it was clear that they, if they bought here, they were directly supporting an artist, that actually led to a sale. So that moment where we saw those kinds of search terms resulting in money getting to artists was really the moment where it felt like, oh yeah, this is going to work.
When we come back in just a moment, more of my conversation with Ethan Diamond and why artists and labels have told Ethan, please don't sell the company. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This Resilience Edition from NPR. The New York Times best-selling book, How I Built This, is now available. It's a great read and a great gift for anyone looking for ideas, inspiration, wisdom, and encouragement to have the courage to put out an idea into the world. It's filled with tons of stories you haven't heard about how some of the greatest entrepreneurs you know and respect started out at the very bottom. Check out How I Built This, the book, available wherever you buy your books. On How I Built This, we dive into stories behind some of the world's most successful and innovative companies. Everyone measures success in different ways, but one thing's for sure, you can't do it alone. Our sponsor, Atlassian, knows this better than anyone. Their team has a suite of software tools like Jira, Loom, and Confluence that power teamwork for millions of companies worldwide, like Canva. Canva, the world's fastest-growing design platform, is on a mission to empower the world to design. The company has grown from launch in 2013 to over 4,500 employees, with more than 175 million people, and over 95% of the Fortune 500 now using Canva to unlock their creativity and achieve their goals at work. Such exponential growth means Canva has had to rapidly scale their internal processes and ways of working to keep up with demand. Atlassian products are helping them navigate that formidable challenge. They use Jira to power their engineering sprints, internal recruitment workflow, and inventory management. Jira Service Management is used for capturing customer feedback and HR requests. With Atlassian, Canva has increased collaboration, processed more than 5,000 tickets per year with ease, and empowered millions of people around the world to bring their creativity to life. Millions of teams around the world like Canva trust Atlassian software to support everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and making beautiful designs. No matter if you're a team of 2 or 2 million, or if you're around the corner or on another continent, Atlassian software keeps everyone connected and moving together as one towards shared goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com. This episode is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for building your brand, engaging your customers, and growing your business online. So if you're running a business like the founders on this show, then you'll love some of Squarespace's features. Whether you sell physical goods, digital content, or services, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online, including lots of payment options for customers at checkout, as well as easy client invoicing. Squarespace also makes email campaigns super easy with customizable email templates for converting subscribers into loyal customers. And Squarespace has tons of analytics so you know where all your site visits and sales are coming from. So check out squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/built to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This Resilience Edition. And I'm talking with Ethan Diamond. He's the CEO and co-founder of Bandcamp, an online record store and music community. I know that your growth has been slow and steady and consistent over time. And last year was a huge growth year. We'll talk about in a moment. But it seems to me that what you've built is a company that is sustainable, where you're able to pay people a decent salary. No one's a billionaire out of Bandcamp. But I have to imagine that there have been times over the past 10 years where you have been approached by bigger companies that want to buy you or investors who want to pump more money into the company to grow it. And that can be tempting for an entrepreneur because, you know, you've got people who work for you and there's a lot of pressure to grow and build and scale. And I wonder how you have resisted that kind of pressure to do that.
Well, yes. Before the pandemic hit, we had regular meetups all the time with artists and labels around the world, really. And the most common thing that that I heard from people, you know, direct from artists and labels during those meetings were things like, hey, I just wanted to come over and say, please don't ever sell the company. You're our last hope, you know, things like that. And, you know, I take that responsibility that, you know, the service that we are now providing to artists and labels, I take it, you know, it's a responsibility I take very, very seriously. So, you know, we would, I think, really only align ourselves with another company that had the welfare of the artist in mind in this same way. And taking money, it can sometimes change your goals, change them to, you know, growth at all costs. And so getting, as you said, getting to profitability, that was a really important milestone for us. We wanted to do that because we wanted to be able to retain control of the company and know that this mission that we have would be around long term.
Yeah. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs are looking to build community around their products. And there's a whole, you know, there are sessions and you know, educational opportunities. And founders are looking to figure out how do you build community. And everyone seems to want to build a media company these days. But it's something that's very difficult to just build, to kind of create out of nothing, right? Especially if it's inauthentic. And I know that you're the sort of one of the central forces of Bandcamp is the community. And it seems to me that the community has really kind of driven the business decisions that you make, right? Like there are fan accounts and there's a social media interface where you can see what other people are buying and listening to. And the community, I mean, especially when you talk about independent music, like they have strong views on what it means to sell out and to compromise. So how much does the community, I mean, how much does the community matter in terms of how you guys think of what you do?
You know, this gets back to your earlier question about, you know, the high fidelity and, you know, being that record store. Because when we started off, because MySpace was kind of the reference point where the community had devolved essentially into people spamming each other's pages with their own flyers and saying, thanks for the ad and things like that. we decided that there wasn't going to be no community on Bandcamp, zero. You know, we were essentially a white label service. In those early days, we were a white label service for artists, and that was it. You know, after a couple years of doing this, and there were enough artists on the site where people started to say, you know, hey, could you tell me, you know, what are the other like math rock bands that are on Bandcamp? And my reaction at first was, you know, I don't understand why you care. You know, just use Google, type math rock into Google and go find other bands, right? But then once we'd gone from maybe 10,000 bands to 100,000 bands, it started to really make sense to me that there was an opportunity here, that there was a group of people, of like-minded fans who want to directly support artists and directly connect with them in this way, and that we have a chance to help facilitate that, right? So we started building the community up, but very carefully, and around the idea that the community is that your ticket to participate in this community is that you are an actual supporter of these artists. So you don't, you know, click a like button or a heart to add something to a collection. You transact, right?
Yeah.
To create a collection. And that gives the collection so much more meaning, right? Because you actually spent a limited resource, right? Your money to create this collection. So, you know, that's become just an incredibly important part of the business. It drives something like 30 plus percent of the sales. So meaning, you know, if you as an artist are adding your music to the site, you know, you can expect that community to find you and draw, and that you benefit from that in a way that would be very different from you just setting up, you know, your own standalone site. So yeah, I feel like the community has gone from something that, you know, I thought, you know, it's just an annoyance to at first, you know, again, based on MySpace, to something that is really a key to the entire thing.
How do you think, Ethan, the music industry will change in a post-pandemic world, if at all?
I think there's good news and bad news about that. You know, I'll start with the bad news. I think, you know, a lot of venues have closed during the pandemic, and I think a lot more are likely to close because the Save Our Stages Act, that passed, but the money hasn't been distributed yet. So I worry about what's going to happen to all those venues. And in the meantime, you know, one of the crazier monopolies that exists between Live Nation, biggest venue owner, promoter, manager of artists, and Ticketmaster, and, you know, Clear Channel / iHeartMedia that owns radio, right? You know, Live Nation has, their stock has tripled during the pandemic. And, you know, you kind of wonder like, well, why is that, right? What's going on? They haven't had a concert in a year. And I think that's just because everybody, well, the market anyway, is expecting the sort of the stranglehold to only get worse, which isn't good for us, you know, music fans, right? The tickets will get more expensive. I think there'll be less diversity in music as a result. But you know, laws are changing, right? There's a lot of antitrust activity that I'm, you know, cautiously optimistic about. But, you know, the other part of the industry, I would say that the good news is that I think a lot of people have rethought how to support artists during the pandemic. And there's been a lot of conversation about like, well, okay, if artists aren't touring or aren't doing shows, what is the way to keep, you know, keep art alive at this time? And how should we be compensating artists? And, you know, that's a conversation that, you know, I feel like that's why we started Bandcamp, right? Because of those issues. So to know that people are thinking about that and that it's changing, that there is a lot more direct support happening through platforms like ours is really encouraging to me.
I know you've got a brick and mortar record store in Oakland, California, and a live venue space there. And presumably it's been challenging to keep those open. But I wonder, given the consolidation in the industry, especially when it comes to live events, is there a world where Bandcamp in a post-pandemic world enters that space and somehow creates venues for, you know, or partners with people to create more independent venues for live events?
We've thought about it for sure. And I think it would be really interesting to get into, you know, our toe dip into this world is our new live streaming service that we really just launched. We've rolled it out now to, it's in about 100,000 artists have been enabled with this, and it allows you to stream to anybody. So, you know, you publish a show, it goes out to all of your followers. You can have an integrated merch table. Seeing some of those early shows, it's very exciting to me because people are buying the merch. There's a chat that's very active. And when somebody buys something, it shows up in the chat. Hey, this person actually just bought this vinyl record. And then that kind of triggers more people to do that. And when I think about how many artists are on Bandcamp, and it seems inevitable that we'll get to this point where all these, there'll be shows happening constantly, and you'll be able to have that experience of, you know, when you go to a town that's a music town like Austin or New Orleans, right? And you walk down a street and you just hear music everywhere around you, and you pop your head in and see what's going on and potentially fall in love with the new artist, right? That's the experience that that I think we'll soon have on Bandcamp.
Is that feature something you rolled out that you had planned to roll out last year, or was that feature a response to what was going on in the pandemic world?
100% a response. Yeah.
Wow. It
was not, we weren't thinking about entering that at all. And in retrospect, it was kind of crazy that we weren't. It was conceived, designed, and built in a very, very short period of time. We moved several people off of other projects to get that done.
I know that last year was a huge year for you. But by the way, what kind of growth did you see in 2020 in terms of, just overall growth?
It was enormous. I mean, it was everything more or less doubled in 2020. So artist signups, fan signups, sales through the site, digital, music, physical music. Yeah.
And I know that last year you started something called Bandcamp Fridays, where I think you started pretty soon after the shutdown in San Francisco, which was March 17th. I think that Friday you basically had this Bandcamp Friday, which was a day where all of the proceeds, except for the processing fees, go to the artist. So you guys waive your commission, and it was huge. You sold $4.5 million worth of music in 24 hours.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, it happened very, very quickly. You know, the pandemic hit, the shutdown happened, we realized, okay, artists are losing a huge part of their, many artists are losing a huge part of their income. What can we, this is our community. What can we do to help? We've had successful fundraisers in the past. When the former president had the Muslim travel ban, we had a really successful fundraiser for ACLU. The former president had the transgender military ban, and we held a very successful fundraiser for the Transgender Law Center. We've done others, and it just felt like, okay, well, what are we going to do? What's the organization that we should support this time? Should it be something in helping support the venues that are shut down, helping maybe support artist healthcare? And ultimately, what we settled on was something very simple, which is waiving our revenue share. And we scrambled to do that. We had our first one on March 20th of last year, and it was huge. It was about 15 times our normal Friday sales. Wow. Which for the systems team, for support, for developers, it was a really big effort to keep the site running and have it keep up with all of that. But obviously the benefit to artists was enormous. And since then we have another one tomorrow, but we've had 11 since then. And just on those days, fans have paid artists $50 million through the site.
Wow. I mean, it is amazing and incredible, and obviously aligns with your mission, but you're also running a company that has to employ. How many employees do you have?
About 100 now.
So you have to pay 100 people and obviously help sustain their lives. So you have to be profitable. And I imagine doing that, having those Bandcamp Fridays where you guys are getting no money, but you're still processing the fees and you still have to work, right, to make that happen. That can't be easy financially for the company to absorb.
We were concerned at the beginning. It was the first one we did. We didn't know how it was going to go at all. And we didn't know that we were going to do another one. And we didn't call it Bandcamp Friday. That's something that just happened, on social media. People started calling it that. And we're like, yeah, that sounds great. Let's embrace that and use that for all of the future ones as well. But what we saw after that first one is that it resulted in a lot of artists driving awareness to their fans that, hey, here's a way to directly support me. And that extends past that day of the month, right? On Bandcamp Friday, 93% of what a fan spends gets to the artist. On the other days of the year, right, it's 82% on average. Yeah. So all days are good days, right, to support an artist. And so the effect of these days has been a big positive, I think, for artists overall. And then because of this alignment of our business model with the interests of the artist, it actually is a huge benefit to Bandcamp as well, the company. So yes, we waive our revenue share on those days, but I feel like, and the numbers prove out that it's been a net benefit for the company overall.
What advice would you give to an entrepreneur who wants to run an ethical business, a mission-focused business like yours, but has the opportunity to grow it very quickly and to scale it, if only they would shift their business model or their values ever so slightly? What would you say to them?
Well, I guess it just completely depends on what that slight shift looks like. I think, you know, my advice and what has served us really, really well has been aligning the business model with the community that we're here to serve. And if the shift still allows you to do that, then the only risk really is, I think, is that you know, the priorities of a major investor aren't necessarily going to be your exact same priorities. You may have find yourself in a situation where you're pushed to sell the company or pushed to grow quickly in a way that risks your mission, right? But yeah, I think that at the core, the problem that I've seen in, you know, previous companies that I've worked at is when there's that misalignment in, you know, what you're apparently here to do versus how you actually make money. So that, and that's typically a problem like in advertising based businesses where, you know, the sales team on the advertising side wants to encroach on the interface as much as possible and get people to see as many ads as possible. And you're, you know, maybe trying to, you know, make a mail program, for example, you know, where you're just trying to make the best possible product that people say subscribe to or something like that. So when that misalignment occurs, I feel like that's when anybody gets into trouble. But that's, I think, the majority also of businesses, right?
That's an excerpt from my live conversation with Ethan Diamond, the CEO and co-founder of Bandcamp. If you want to see the full interview or any of our past live interviews, you can find them on the How I Built This Facebook page or at youtube.com/NPR. And if you want to join our conversation live and maybe even ask questions, they happen every Thursday at 9 Pacific, noon Eastern. If you want to find out more about the How I Built This Resilience series or other virtual NPR events, you can go to nprpresents.org. This episode was produced by Liz Metzger with help from Farah Safari, JC Howard, Bruce Grant, El Mannion, Gianna Capadona, John Isabella, Julia Carney, Neva Grant, and Jeff Rogers. Our intern is Janet Ujong Lee. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I'll see you in a few days. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This Resilience Edition from NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Reyes Sehorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.